First, thank you for inviting me. Gigi already suggested, my point of departure is a quotation from a famous book by Norbert Elias, Über den Prozess der Zivilisation, on the civilizing process, in which he has, I will read the quotation in English. Religion, the belief in the punishing or rewarding omnipotence of God, never has itself in itself a civilizing or effect-subduing effect. On the contrary, religion is always exactly as civilized as a society or class which upholds it. This is the only phrase on the subject of this conference in a book of more than 800 pages. Now, to understand this statement on religion in this famous study on the civilizing process, first requires a brief summary of the author's main argument. I assume that a few of you know about this book, so I have to summarize the argument, which I think is very interesting. You don't have to agree with it, but it's very interesting and encouraging comparative research of civilizing processes elsewhere. Using etiquette books, manner books, as one of its main sources, Elias found that in Western Europe, between about 1200 and 1800, people developed a more balanced, all-around, and stable control over their affects and bodily functions. He argued that this growing internalization of constraints, as expressed in manners and codes of conduct concerning violence, eating, sleeping, sexuality, illness, and dying, in his word habitus, a concept we know from Bourdieu, who probably got it from Elias, developed with the growing differentiation of society. As Elias put it in the opening session of his conclusion, as the social fabric grows more intricate, the social genetic apparatus of individual self-control also becomes more differentiated, more all-around, and more stable. I will repeat this, because this is, in a nutshell, the argument. As the social fabric grows more intricate, the sociogenetic apparatus of self-control, individual self-control, also becomes more differentiated, more all-round, and more stable. The book consists of two volumes. The first volume is about habitus, all the documentation of the changes in etiquette. And the second volume deals with what changed in society over the same period. Elias suggests not a real causal connection. He has a concept which comes back all the time in his analysis, in German Verflechtung, which is interweaving. These processes are interwoven. But it is possible to read the book as a causal analysis. The society becomes more complicated, more differentiated, and the psychological makeup of people, their personality, becomes also more differentiated. Rules of etiquette, like other cultural practices, are moral prescriptions and proscriptions. Yet, for Elias, the term civilized did not have any superior moral implication or any association with the notion of progress. On the contrary, he discovered a largely unplanned but structured process in a specific direction, but without a goal, in which, over the centuries, in Western Europe, from the top down and from centers to peripheries, people developed more balanced and differentiated restraints and controls of their effects and bodily functions. He traced this process from a comparative study of etiquette books over time and showed how these changes were structured. What do we mean by structured? First, these processes went in the same direction, namely differentiation. Second, they affected a large variety of social and cultural domains of everyday life. I've mentioned them, I repeat them again, including the preparation and serving of food, table manners, relations between the sexes, architecture of houses, and practicing concerning illness and death. Third, and spelled out in the second volume of this magnum opus, the growing differentiation of restraints and controls over effects and bodily functions did not develop in a vacuum, but was inextricably connected, interwoven, vervlochten with the differentiation of social networks and the formation of centralized states. In these transformations of society and habitus in late medieval and early modern Europe, the centralization of power, the development of a stable central control over the means of violence played a vital role, a pivotal role. As specified enclaves, the royal courts functioned as the atelier, the workshop of the civilizing process. It forged its main tools, of which the fork, La Forchetta, was a telling example. And over a long period of time, turned a warrior nobility into a pacified court nobility. To survive as nobles, they had to leave their rural residence and go to the royal court, where they had, in a Darwinian struggle, to compete for favors from a powerful king. More balanced self-restraints and refined manners with respect to a range of bodily functions served as marks of distinction, first among the competing nobles themselves, later between nobles and bourgeois, and still later between the bourgeois and the working class. The court served as a model. Etiquette became a power structure in its own right. As Elias specified later in a more general comment on civilizing processes, codes of civilized conduct helped to enhance the chances of superior groups to assert and maintain their power and superiority. You see here how Elias tried to conceptualize the connection, not simple cause and effect, but things that work on each other. In short, Elias's analysis encompasses two interwoven aspects of the same transformation: the differentiation of social networks required differentiation of habitus, which underwrote the expanding web of interdependencies. Both worked back on each other. A similar interconnection prevailed with the centralization of power. The concept of differentiation, we talked about it this morning, differentiation of society, the concept of differentiation looms large in Elias's view. He points at an important telltale sign, clue of the civilization curve: the growing differentiation between what we call private and public domains. The distasteful of what had become distasteful was removed behind the scenes of social life, dans les coulisses de vie de la vie publique. It will be seen again and again writes Elias, how this characteristic of the whole process that we call civilization is a movement of segregation, this hiding behind the scenes of what has become distasteful. These gradual displacements of what have become distasteful to specialized enclaves behind the scenes involved a gradual reorganization of social and cultural space. They included cooking, eating and sleeping in separate rooms, the use of violence extramuros outside the city, all the duels, the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, took place in liminal areas outside the towns. Violence was confined to barracks. Police and army were not around, they were enclosed in barracks, not to be seen, behind the scenes. And we can add, because we know more in the meantime, since this book was published in 1939, we can add to this series of displacements the removal of slaughterhouses and cemeteries from the center to the periphery of the towns. There's a beautiful book by one of our French colleagues, Noël Viales, if I pronounce your name correctly, on the displacement of slaughterhouses from the center of towns in an area in France to the periphery. And we can understand this process, this movement, in terms of the civilizing process. The same goes for cemeteries. Thick book by another Frenchman, Philippe Ariès, L'Homme de Vandemour, describes how bodies, people who had died, were not any longer buried in churches, but were buried outside of the town. It's significant. Telltale sign of the civilizing process. The perfunctionary way in which Elias dealt with the role of religion in this quotation I read to you may have followed from a theoretical position, which I spelled out three times now. His sociogenetic and psychogenetic analysis of the civilizing process and his model of intertwinement of long-term transformations leave little room for religion or any other factor or cause as a driving force or the elaboration of civilized codes. In his view, religion is part of what has to be explained, not part of the answer. It's part of changes in religious beliefs and practices have to be understood in a specific context, as part of a pattern or process. In particular, they are part of the changes of habitus. By themselves, they do not explain much. This is one of the points I want to raise for discussion. Another reason why Elias virtually dismissed religion from his account of civilizing processes may have been his polemic against Max Weber. His name has been mentioned before. Who, as you know, assigned a key role to religion in the development of capitalism in Europe and the United States. I think Elias didn't want simply to repeat what Weber had said, so he was very critical of Weber. He had learned from Weber, but he was also critical and he tried to make his own position, own theoretical framework, in which there was, and we have to ask questions about, there was very little place for religion. We're trying to understand it. Why? Because it didn't explain very much. It has to be explained. Third, Elias may have tried to avoid spelling out a relationship that is almost commonplace in everyday conversation. Not least as a hangover of the colonial experience, including the civilizing efforts of missionaries. Everyone believes that religion has a major role in the crystallization of civilized behavior. And Elias didn't want to repeat this. It's my assumption. Fourth and finally, Elias may have taken issue with the category of religion itself. I didn't discuss it with him. It's just my hunch, you know, my feeling that he was very interested in language, in conceptualization. And I believe that he had a point here. Religion, I think quotation marks, is part of a modern Western classification system that orders the world in terms of distinct and separated categories. Religion here, politics there, economics there, kinship here, sexuality there, in a differentiated Western society with a strong degree of secularization. Religion became a department. Ironically, this way of conceptualizing religion betrays a high degree of social differentiation. This is not how religious beliefs and practices are conceptualized in societies where these beliefs are more pervasive and may permeate virtually all aspects of life. For example, the common phrase Islam is more than a religion, it is a way of life, makes us immediately aware of the limits that pertain to the use of the term religion as a category that can be easily defined and distinguished and separated from other and social and cultural domains. It may be a result of secularization to talk about religion as something separate from other domains. And that's a Western ethnocentric point of view. So there's another point for discussion. So the question whether religious beliefs and practices had any effect on civilizing codes remains still open. As mentioned before, Elias identified the royal court as the atelier, as the workshop of the civilizing process, and also recognized it as a model. He considered the court as a center of power and culture from which radiated more civilized codes of conduct. This involved a spatial movement from center to periphery and a hierarchical movement from top to bottom. Started at king, court, nobility, bourgeoisie, working class. The dominance of centers over the peripheries and the importance of their social and cultural radiation should not, however, blind us to the impact of peripheries. Can have, and indeed did have, on their centers. This is a theme on which I'm working on for a couple of years, collecting materials. Actually, this paper is kind of a satellite effort of that research. I'm interested, as I said before this morning, in the impact from peripheries on centers, whether in science or art or religion or politics or kinship, family. I think I can make a case for a necessary condition for creative achievement is to be an outsider, not to be in the center, but to be on the outside. That is my general position. And this paper, in a way, tries to illustrate it for the field of religion. And I give you some examples now, and you can think about it, to what extent I am having a point. Following Elias, referring to Elias and defining the notion of civilizing in terms of effect subduing code of conduct, the Dutch medievalist Michael Jong investigated the codes of conduct in a Carolingian monastery near Lecco, northern Italy, around the middle of the 9th century. 9th century, not 19th, 9th century, medievalist. A monastery that followed the rules of Benedictus of Nursia, which dominated all West European monasteries between about 700 and 1200. On the basis of a commentary by the monk Hildemar, who visited this place in northern Italy between 845 and 850, she shows that these rules did not involve any severe asceticism, pas de austérité, but were characterized by a balanced self-restraint according to the rules of Benedictus, who did not prescribe any self-castigation. On the contrary, the ascetic ideal of these monastic rules are appropriately rendered by the warning ne quid nimis, Latin for nothing too much, moderation. Key concept in the Benedictine tradition is therefore the discretio, that is, the skill to present oneself in a measured and moderate fashion, especially in cases of disciplinary affairs. No hitting, no beating up, no violence. The monks were further expected to avoid emotional extremes and to lead a quiet and retired life. Complex ideals of humbleness, modesty, and simplicity was expressed in subtle controls of speech, gesture, and posture, rather than in a full denial and humiliation of one's body. On this point, Jung takes issue with Elias, who recognized that self-control was not entirely lacking in medieval society or in other societies without a complex and stable monopoly of physical violence, yet compared to the self-control agency in more pacified societies, namely Das Abendland, Western Europe, later, it is diffuse, unstable, only a slight barrier to violent emotional outbursts. In certain sectors of society, medieval society, we find extreme forms of asceticism, self-restraint and renunciation, contrasting to a no less extreme indulgence of pleasure in others in the life of an individual person. De Jong, the medievalist who examines the rules of Benedictus in this North Italian monastery, De Jong agrees that extreme ascetic traditions could also be found in the early Middle Ages. Yet, the Benedictine tradition, which has had most influence on monasticism in Europe, precisely rejected extreme asceticism. This implies an important and a correction to the picture sketched by Elias. The visiting monk and chronicler Hildemar wanted to educate monks in the spirit of a stable an all-round regulation of their conduct, that is, affect control in the sense Elias had in mind. The monks were supposed to distinguish themselves from the surrounding world by their self-control in order to maintain the distance between claustrum and sacrum, between sacred and profane. Although Hildemar's code of conduct was intended for monks, we should not underestimate the influence of this model. We know that monasticism in the early Middle Ages developed as a religious and political center of Carolingian society, writes De Jong, in spite of the interweaving of monasticism with this aristocratic society, the ideal of world renouncing and isolation never got completely lost. Again and again, reform movements tried to create new forms of isolation. This forced monks like Hildemar to redefine their code of behavior. Precisely because their isolation remained relative, given the sacred political and economic position of power, the influence of monastic norms did not remain confined to the monasteries themselves. They also had an effect on the world outside their walls. So long before royal courts became ateliers and models of a civilized standard, monasteries prefigured this development. The North Italian Benedict case also invites a further correction of Elias' view, because it presents us with an example of innovation in which new standards of behavior did not move from centers to peripheries or from top to the bottom, but the other way around. It remains to be investigated how often and in what different settings across time and place the periphery functioned as a locus of innovation. When looking at major historical transformations that had their origin in peripheries and recognizing their innovative impact on centers, one cannot ignore the part of religiously inspired effect subduing codes. Recall that Christianity originated in the periphery of the Roman Empire and from the ranks of the working class, artisanal class, poor people of a major city, Jerusalem. After its prophet had retired to a remote location in the desert for inspiration. Keep this in mind. Prophets go to the periphery for enlightenment, away from the center. Innovation again in peripheries. Often the periphery of the periphery of the periphery. And often periphery in more than one sense, not only spatial, also culturally or socially. Away from power. When the new faith gradually spread to the metropolitan center itself, Rome, its peaceful protagonists and proponents initially suffered further setbacks and persecutions, until in the early 4th century, the Roman emperor accepted their belief. Constantine the Great, we are told, did so also in the hope of promoting the unity of the empire, and said, once famous, almost cliché quotation, in hoc signo vinces, in dit teken zal ik overwinnen, in Dutch. Again, we have here something that was brought up this morning, the close intertwinement of religion and politics. We have separate words, we have separate concept, but in reality, they belong together in a certain type of society. 2 centuries later, a similar innovation took shape in another peripheral location, with respect to Rome, when, following the conversion of Ireland by St. Patrick in the middle of the 5th century, Irish and Anglo-Saxon Benedictine monks undertook the Christianization of the European continent, organized an expanding network of monasteries, self-subsistent monasteries, and inspired by Benedict's rules of moderation and stability, the ascetic monks were not required to indulge in heroic fasts or ingenious self-inflicted torments, as we already learned from Michael Jung's report from his North Italian case, but expected to lead a hard and highly disciplined life in accordance with the ideals of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Monastery then indeed prefigured the development and propagation of more civilized standards of behavior at European courts in late medieval and early modern periods, by almost 1,000 years. Recall that monasteries were also centers of learning and set the tone for universities, which developed later. Significantly, several of the most famous universities in Europe and elsewhere, shared their peripheral location with monasteries and were sometimes built on the same grounds as their architecture and denomination suggest. Think of Europe. You have, of course, everyone knows this, Cambridge and Oxford, little towns far away from London. Why is that? Uppsala, far away from Stockholm, Coimbra, Salamanca, Leuven in Belgium, Leiden, and then in Germany, Heidelberg, Tübingen, Göttingen, a whole string of universities that are not in cities. You have to ask yourself, why? First, you have to see a pattern. You have to see that it's not only Heidelberg, of not only Stanford, of not only Princeton. When you see a pattern, there's a question. Why? Then you have to use your imagination and your erudition and some historical knowledge that there is continuity in monasteries and universities on a couple of scores. Relative isolation and coming up with new ideas. I know that universities today are also bureaucracies, no new ideas. But still, it has this potential, and it has this potential. So when we see that many of them, not all of them, have this outside position, there may be something to be said for the thesis that for creative achievement, an outsider's position is not sufficient, but is necessary. That is to say that outside, not all outsiders are brilliant people, but outsidership is a necessary condition for coming up with something new. Following the revival, this is only one short paragraph to mention another example. Following the revival of trade and urban life in the 11th century Europe, the new towns also predated royal courts as models of civility. Specified enclaves, they formed a complex network of interdependencies that both required and created the conditions for a more balanced, all-round and stable habitus. In his famous book, American historian wrote about France, Eugene Weber, no connection, with Max Weber. Eugene Weber wrote a book, Peasants into Frenchmen. Some of you may know it, read it. Weber reminds us that civilization is urban, civilian, civilized. And so, of course, is urbanity. Just as polity, politeness, politics, and police spring from polis, Greek word polis, the city again. Then I make another jump in this short paper to an area and a tradition which is much better known by most of you than by me. But I only want to call it into attention. About the same time, about the time, 7th century, we're just talking about the 7th century, that voluntary exile monks made Europe a Christian continent, a new civilization began to take shape in another peripheral area, the peninsula of Arabia, sort of no man's land between the Byzantine and Persian empires. The impact of a peripheral prophet warrior on main centers of the old world are well known and has been summarized as follows. I have a quotation from book, but I think I don't have to, this company, I don't have to tell you anything about it. I want only to emphasize that is another example of a world religion that started in a peripheral zone. And there is a family resemblance between the way Christianity became dominant and in which Islam became dominant. Doctrines, if not also the practices of both Christianity and Islam, signal two critical elements of the civilizing process, described and interpreted by Elias. First, an emphasis on a differentiated habitus and an emphasis on a differentiated network of interdependencies. In this respect, Constantine and Mohammed, who were both military leaders, had the same ambitions. They both hoped that a common belief, demanding more self-discipline and effect control, would help the development of political unity. Again, it is a combination of religion and politics. I'm coming to the end of my presentation. Successful conversions are probably the most radical transformation that people, individually and socially, can experience. I cannot think myself of anything more encompassing. Religious conversion totally changes the way people see their place in the world. In a detailed analysis of the language and politics of Christian fundamentalism in the United States, Susan Harding, anthropologist, American anthropologist, shows how born-again Christians, also called evangelicals, Bible-believing Christians, or fundamentalists, moved in a single decade, 1980s, to a mainstream position. In discussing conversion, Harding notes, born-again knowledge becomes the centering principle of your identity, your personal and public life, your view of human nature and history. And it involves joining a particular narrative tradition to which you willingly submit your past, your present, and future. There is no such thing as a coincidence in born-again culture. God's hand is everywhere. This is only a contemporary example taken from the United States of the problems one encounters when conceptualizing religion and reifying this concept in terms of a modern Western epistemology that orders the world in separated categories. To conclude, the questions Elias raised in the foreword of his magnum opus, Über den Prozess der Zivilisation, how did this civilizing of the West actually happen? Of what did it consist? And what were its causes or motive forces? Cannot be satisfactorily answered without paying attention to the variety of models in the formation of habitus, including those developed in peripheries. Apart from and well before the royal courts came to being, there were the monasteries, and following the monasteries, there were the towns and cities. There's a whole program for research open. Thank you very much.